Chats, the show where I, Josh Pigford, founder of Bearmetrics, hop on a call with other founders and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Kash Sajati, founder of Cloud66. In this episode, we talk about growing up in Iran, how hobby electronics became a conduit for building software, selling software as a teenager to realtors and dentists, learning the value of unit economics, the importance of scheduling your day, and a whole lot more. Hey, Kash, thanks for hopping on a call. How are things going?
All great. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, we talk a lot about founder sort of, I guess, origin stories a lot on the podcast. And I like to start like the very beginning on these things. So, like, where did you grow up? What were you like as a kid?
Oh, so I grew up, of all places, in Iran, which is a country that's mostly associated with burning American flag and all. You know, what you see in the media sort of thing.
Sure.
Yep. So I grew up there. I went to university as a mechanical engineer, like trained as a mechanical engineer. And I moved to the UK because I started a business back in Iran. And that business could not be sustained in a country that was constantly under sanctions. So back in Iran, and I'm talking about 1997, 1996, like many other countries back then, we had dial-up ISPs, and the idea was that you would go and buy a satellite link or some sort of, you know, connection to the internet, and then you will divvy up and then sell it as a dial-up thing. And a lot of those were priced based on the time of the day that you would connect, or how long you were connected, whether you had like a 24/7 access or just rush hour or off-peak or whatever else. So there was like different pricing of internet, which sounds alien now, when you have ubiquitous like internet everywhere and Wi-Fi.
Sure.
But believe it or not, that was the story back then. So what I did was we wrote a tool that would analyze the log files of these systems, RAS systems they were called back then, that would log every call and then dial in and then, you know, disconnection. And we would measure how long a customer was connected to each line, so you could build them accordingly. And then later on, use that log analysis to disconnect them when they're outside the hours. So because all these different ISPs were using different systems, we kind of decided that we go down the route of reading log files, which was everybody would produce, so we don't have to integrate with every single different permutations of the different systems. So we did that. And it was a very successful product. We rolled it out and we started selling it. And then from there, we got into just log analysis in general, which meant it was actually much more interesting, because then we could start looking into anomalies, intrusion detection, things that you couldn't really see in a log file by just looking at it. It needed deeper analysis. And we started selling those, and it turned out to be a very successful story around the banks and the financial industry, because they really wanted to kind of go through the huge amount of log files that it would produce from these ancient systems they had. And as you can imagine, all these systems were, I don't know, mainframes and minis and VEX, if I remember correctly, like really old systems, like, you know, mini computers back then. So you couldn't really kind of connect a PC and, you know, modernize it. So what we did, we used our technology again to use the log files as a conduit to connect it to a new modern system and started selling that. So when we did that, then we thought, oh, that's a great thing. Why don't we just go into the international market and start selling it? The problem with that was, as always, in the past 30 or so years since the Iranian Revolution, Iran's always been under sanction around the, you know, exporting and importing and anything that's to do with technology and pretty much anything else. So we set up shop in Dubai, in Arab Emirates, with an aim to focus on the Middle Eastern market. And Middle Eastern market, if you are familiar with the region, is basically Egypt, Jordan, and Israel, where the biggest kind of markets. Again, politics came first. So we couldn't sell to Israel because none of the Middle Eastern countries want to trade with Israel, so we couldn't do that, which left us with a smaller market. So at that point, I decided that I want to move to Europe, set up the company there so we can trade with the entire world, because I frankly don't care for politics much, and I just wanted to do business and, you know, build something cool and sell it.
Sure.
So with that, at the age of, 24, I moved to the UK, moved to London, and set up the company there with an aim to sell our product to the world.
So what were you, so before even all that, like what got you into computers?
Oh, wow. That really goes back. So I remember it was completely by accident. It was very much based on my love for building things. When I was, I must have been like 12. At the age of 12, there was a test that our that school did, like aptitude test or whatever you want to call it. You know, some yep. mix of learned and innate skills, if you will. And I did really well at school. And then I got to the county and then the city and the county and the country and region, all that sort of thing. So I did really well on those things. And then the school wanted to give me the prize for having won all these kind of different things. And I know that they wanted to give me like a certificate and a bust of a scientist or mathematician or something, which for a 12-year-old probably wouldn't have been that exciting. I think my dad got a wind of that and thought, well, that's not going to really inspire this kid after having gone through all of this. So here, I think he added a couple of electronic kits. You know, if you're old enough, you remember those ones, right? You could get a soldering kit and, you can just put it something like a flasher or a siren or whatever else. And I remember, I vividly remember that I had a two LED, or even maybe not even LEDs, maybe just normal light bulbs, a flasher and a siren. Two kits that my dad, unbeknown to me, added to this prize list of a bust and a certificate. And I really got into it. I really got into that. And I subscribed to the only electronics magazine that was published in Iran just to know more about it because it was such an amazing thing. And it got to the point that I would get my dad to drive me to another place that would sell these things and spend a lot of money on this. And my dad was like, you know what? I think I made a mistake. Here's your pocket money. You have this limit. That's, you're allowed to spend only your pocket money. And my pocket money would not, I wouldn't, the things that I wanted to build, I couldn't build it with my pocket money. So at one point, it got to the point that I subscribed to this magazine and they rolled out one special issue on this thing called computers. So I was just engrossed with this thing. I went and read it, and I remember vividly there was a day, and it was very kind of few moments in your life that you kind of remember that you sat down as a kid and thought about something and made a decision. But I think that was probably the only time that I did that. I sat down and I thought, you know what? Why do I like electronics so much? I think it's because I really like building things. So if I put all of my money together and buy one computer, then I can just build computer programs. Then it's just one-off investment. I don't need to spend all of my pocket money on electronic kits, but are one-offs. I then can just build computer programs, but in an upfront investment. So that led to a lot of other things and borrowing money from my dad and all sorts of things that ended up with me and a Commodore 64 computer back then. And yes, that's how I got into computers. And I remember spending all my summers just writing code.
Well, you had spent so much time working on the hardware side of things. What was it about the software? Was it purely the economics of it that sort of drew you to it? Or was there something about software that struck a nerve more than the electronics, hardware side of things?
So the primary initial driver was the economics of it, as you put it. I just couldn't afford hardware. That was one. The second one, again, comes in the diversity of the sanctions, was that I was really interested in radio and communication. And I think it wasn't actually sanctions. It was just something, like a country that comes out of a revolution, they clamped down anything that could, facilitate communication between the opposition. So if you're familiar with electronics, you have these crystal quartz components that would regulate the modulate the frequency of the communication. That basically means if you have a walkie-talkie, for example, when you press the button, you can actually find each other on the same frequency, and then the walkie-talkies are not going to go out of sync after a while because of the lay of land or whatever that might be, the mountains or whatever. And there are these components that regulate this frequency stability. And those components were banned from the market in Iran because people could build contraband communication devices with. And that kind of put another hurdle in front of me. So I thought, you know, with software, there was another way of actually communicating. While back then, actually, there was no network, but I could like write something and then record it on the tape and give it to somebody else. That's the kind of level of things. And then there were obviously BBSs and stuff, but it was before Commodore 64. That was the first driving factors. But at the same time, I didn't have a very strong maths background, and designing computer chips and or computer boards and electronics, I got to a point that my maths just let me down. I couldn't really go further. I just got to the limits of how much I knew about mathematics and all that sort of stuff. And software was a kind of a new avenue that allowed me to be more focused on the practical parts of things, application of things, as opposed to the theoretical very building blocks of it.
Got it. So you mentioned not being great at math. What, like, as a student, like, what, were you a good student? Did you enjoy school?
Yes, I was a good student until I got into computers. I really do. Yeah, that was the story. So I got into, I was like, you know, I was doing, you know, getting great grades and all that sort of stuff. I went to school for gifted children, and there I realized I'm not that gifted. So kind of that was a setback. So as a result of that, I kind of realized, so I was used to kind of going to school and kind of cruising because I it was easy for me. And then as soon as I went to that school, I realized that, you know, I'm not that bright after all. There were lots of other very bright kids. And I struggled a lot to just, you know, catch up. And I think one of the things that happened is that I found that, you know what, I'm actually good in this computer thing, so I'm just going to put all my energy into this. So basically, you know, I got out of the school system and I got out, I went to the university and all that sort of stuff. But at the end, it was just enough to get by, not necessarily. And I never practiced in mechanical engineering. I don't know what mechanical engineering really is. I have a degree, but that's pretty much it. That was the story. Computers were pretty much, since the age of 12, it's been this thing that occupied and got my focus.
Sure. So, okay, so you went to school for mechanical engineering. At what point along the way did business or entrepreneurship sort of come into the picture?
It was very, very early. I remember my dad started his own company when I was, must have been maybe four or five. And I don't remember much back then. All I remember is that he would work 6 days a week, take one day off. And on the sixth day, which was, the whole office was off, but my dad would go back to the office and work, he would take me with him. And it was an engineering firm. He's actually a mechanical engineer, but he's a practicing one and a good one. So I remember getting, like, you know, all the drawing things, and, you know, it was pens and pencils and, you know, old school. I really enjoyed that environment. And I remember I used to, as a kid, I used to sit in the room when my dad had a lot of his business meetings, the one that he would allow me to sit. You know, I would just, you know, draw and color in and whatever as a kid would do. But I would listen to the conversations, and it always intrigued me how people worked, how work was conducted. Not necessarily what was it, because as a, you know, like 5, 6, 7 year old, I couldn't understand a word of what they're saying. But I could get that there is this kind of tension, and then how did they kind of work around this? And way later on, I realized that all of those things again was the creation story. I really like to build things. And one of those things that I enjoyed building was business and company. Companies are, you know, something you build. And that was another part that I was observing. I was watching a company being built. He's still the owner of that company. He's still, his business is still going well. And, you know, that was kind of the building, the beginning of it. And so that was kind of at the very early age, I realized that kind of enjoy doing this. But later on, when it turned out to something that I actually did, from the age of, I think, 14, 15, I started to write computer programs and sell it. So I did a bunch of computer programs for real estate people to just track the properties that were on the market. Then I moved on to a bunch of other things.
How are you, I mean, at 14 or 15 writing these programs, like, how are you even getting that the word out to be able to sell it to people?
That's a good question. So it's kind of usually most of those ideas would come to me from a conversation at a, I don't know, like a family gathering or something from a, like a family member who happens to be a real estate agent or a dentist, because I did another software program for dentist offices. And I remember both of those came out of that. So I wrote the program on a, I think, the first one was in a Commodore, which was interesting to just distribute because, you know, the secretary had to come in and load the disk or the tape even back then, like,
right,
15 minutes before they can just get started. And then I sold it to the first one, and then from word of mouth through the network of their dentist friends or whatever else that was,
sure,
I started selling that.
And how many, like what kind of money are we talking about here?
Just you know, I wasn't really interested. I really didn't care back then for the money that much. It was mostly about building, right, and selling it. So for me, I would say it was like pocket money plus. You know, as a 16-year-old, I was quote unquote flushed between my friends.
Sure.
But I'm sure I could have sold it for a lot more. But I enjoyed it more than the money.
Gotcha. Okay, so that sort of like kicks off the software side and the business side of things. And you mentioned, I guess you were around 24 when you decided to, did the sort of jump from Iran to Dubai and then ultimately to the UK for this business that you had going. What became of that? That was a tool for what, for like ISPs? Was that still the same thing?
It was. So two things happened. Right before I left Iran, I started working on two other ideas as well. One was, and this is 1998, 1999. The two ideas that I started working on. One was a bookmark sharing site that you could just save your bookmarks on one computer and then get it on the other one. Now, remember, this is before the mobile days, obviously, but this is even before a lot of people had laptops. I mean, laptops were something that you would carry, you know, proper. So you had these desktops, and I had one at the office of the company, and then I had one at home. And my issue was that I would go on the internet, and I would just, you know, have these sites that I find on Yahoo or Excite or Alta Vista or wherever that was, and I would save them on my bookmarks, but I couldn't sync it. So I built this thing back then, which was very similar to what Delicious turned out to be. Mm-hmm. And then and park that now. And then I also built another thing. Back then there was a chat software called ICQ. And then I think MSN was not even out yet. There was ICQ, obviously Skype and anything else was not. And what I wanted to do was to have a private ICQ, something that I could run within the company. Think about it as Slack back in 1999.
Right.
So I wrote this private chat server and client, and I wrote it in Delphi, I remember, of all languages, because I really like writing the new WebSocks and all that sort of things around Windows. So I wrote those two things, and I wanted to launch it internationally. And obviously the whole sanction, whatever, was there. But also I wanted $100,000. I calculated that I need $100,000 to launch this thing properly, and I couldn't get that money. There is no venture capital investment whatsoever. Well, at least was not back then, or anybody who had that kind of money around me. So that plus the fact that we couldn't launch our product internationally, the log analysis tool, made me think that, you know, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to go to London because I could speak English barely, kind of. I mean, better than probably French or other European languages. Sure. I could go there. And I could pursue both. That was the idea that I came over. At the same time, there was a Canadian company called WebTrends, and they were doing log analysis software as well. And as soon as I got to the UK, I remember their product was inferior to ours. It was very small. It was a, you know, they would just burn a CD and then give it to you. We had all the whole thing shrink wrapped, and it was much nice. And we were cheaper as well because we could produce it at a lower price. But they were bought by NetIQ, which was a huge giant back then. And that was the end of story for us. We basically got nowhere with that. They killed us. So that's what happened. That right after I arrived at the UK just to do this, that went away.
How did you feel like you've essentially moved to two different countries at this point, sort of pursuing this, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden the kind of just gets completely shut down. I mean, like, what was that like?
It wasn't fun, I tell you. It was devastating. But I learned a very, very good lesson. And that was no matter how much, how better your product is and all of that, you have to be international from day one. You have to think about it from a global point of view from day one, and you have to get to the market as fast as you can. Those were the two things that I learned from that. But I spent a good couple of months not really going out, staring at the walls.
I mean, were you worried that you had made a mistake in moving?
I was lucky enough that my skill set was kind of in demand and always, I'm talking now about 2000, 1999, 2000. So the crash was just about to happen. It just kind of happened in 2000, but 1999 was like, everybody was like, is it going to crash? So back then it was a kind of a heyday of being a computer programmer. So as soon as this happened, I thought, oh shoot, I don't have any money. And I'm in a different country. So what the hell am I going to do? And I found myself a job. And I got sucked into completely new working culture and a different language and still doing programming, but it was completely new to me. A lot of other things were new to me, and I kind of got consumed into that. So I never had a chance. It never kind of got the chance to think about, like, did I make a mistake? Was it a bad choice? I basically found a job and just to pay the bills, and then I got myself busy again.
So at what point did you, after you start working this other job, did you start sort of getting the itch to build something yourself?
Pretty quickly. You know how it is, and you got the bug and it just keeps coming back. So I think it was maybe 2004. So 2004. 2004. So again, the same thing happened. At the company that I used to work, we had these large files that we would FTP back and forth between different offices. And then it was like a CSV file that we would just FTP up to the other office. And in the morning, some person would come in, get the file, and then upload it to a database with a CSV uploader or something. So I thought, that's a bit useless. So what I did was I wrote a FTP to database thing. So on the surface, it was an FTP server, but it was actually backed by databases. So every database table was a file in FTP server. So you would connect with a normal FTP server, and you had to define the mapping between fields and columns, there. But then you would upload a file, and it would just end up in a database. And then when you would download, in real time, would download the entire table as a file for you based on the mapping that you were provided. And the mappings were based on who logged in to the FTP server, so you could have the same file presented, same table being presented to different people as different files. And I wrote it for the company, but I wrote it in, and I signed the contract with them that gave me the rights to the product, that I could sell it to other people as well. And that was the next thing that I did. So I started selling that. And this time I was in the UK. I could actually sell it online. And I made some money around just selling that tool.
Did you enjoy obviously you've got the software sort of technical just building side, which you mentioned, like enjoying the building process.
Yep.
Did you enjoy the sales sort of marketing side of things?
No, that's not something that I enjoy most of the time. Still, that's the case. I'm mostly a product person and an engineer. That's not my comfort zone, and that's what I have to push myself pretty much still. That's the case. I started looking at it from a different point of view now, which is about building the company. And I look at it and I'm interested in that part, but back then it wasn't. So the way I started selling that was, again, selling through companies who knew the company, and I started putting a website together. And frankly, I sold to MasterCard and I sold to GE Agriculture and a bunch of other companies. But all of those sales just happened. It wasn't that I went out and had a sales pitch. And remember, I was working, so I couldn't really afford to just, take a couple of days off every day, every week, and go and like sit in a sales meeting. Right. So, you know, I put it online, and I think it was Fast Sprint or Spring or some like online processing thing, Element 5, I think back then, online credit card thing. So I would set it online with self-service. So, you know, I probably was a lot more potential, but because of my lack of enthusiasm and skill set in marketing and sales, we never kind of got it to the fullest potential.
Got it. So like what came of that software that you were selling?
It went pretty well. It had a good run. But I never pursued it as a business. It was mostly a tool that would just make some side money for me. And you know, all this, FTP thing was not necessarily the most, enduring of the things that, you know, carried over as the internet became more prominent. So, this wasn't necessarily a business. It was mostly a tool that had its run, and you know, sold some licenses, and some of them might still be in production. It's a pretty simple tool that does a very specific job, and that was it. So after a while, I started another thing as a business, and I sold the assets of the company and moved on.
Got it. So what was the next sort of like you starting a thing, like your own company, like not just sort of like working in a place and then like building this sort of tool, mm-hmm. you know, but like you starting an official company.
Yeah. So, kind of the pattern before this was, we did a couple of things. One was with my current co-founder at Cloud 66. And the one before that was with the first employee at Cloud 66. So the first thing that I, right after that, what I did was we started this business called Onyaka, and it was a online workforce rostering or scheduling. So the idea was that it was kind of like a calendar, and you would put who was on the payroll and when they're on, when they're off, and who needs to cover what day at what site. And it would just, you know, allocate people to those sites based on the calendar and their off days and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we got a lot of traction. We got picked up by a bunch of really high traffic websites. So we started that. It was kind of by accident. I was chatting with a friend of mine. And back then, I was working at Lehman Brothers, of all places. So when he was lucky, and I thought he's unlucky. So the story is that we both were working at Lehman Brothers, and you know, Lehman Brothers was like a very big investment bank. Nobody knew right. that it's going to go the way it went. So my friend was made redundant before Lehman went down. And I thought, ooh, that's unlucky. But he got a good package, a really generous package out of Lehman Brothers. And I thought, yeah, you know, I'm lucky I didn't get that. So he left, and he had a bunch of money, and he didn't have to do anything for a while. And we were just talking about this. So we worked together while I was still at Lehman Brothers, and he was out. We built this thing. And then obviously a year later, the whole company went down, and I ended up in the same place, but without any package. so after all, I wasn't the lucky one. But then, so that was the business that we built as a result of the whole financial thing that happened to Lehman Brothers and pretty much the entire world. So we did this with this website. It was a SaaS service, subscription based, and the premise was that we would just get companies to sign up, and they put their people on. And we will just, you know, charge them based on that. And for some reason, we had, I think, free tier. And for some reason, we picked up a lot of traction in churches in the U.S. I don't know why, and still to this day, I've never kind of spent that much time to figure out why do a lot of churches need rostering software. But apparently they do. So we picked up a lot of that. And while it was a great, you know, user base, there was not much revenue coming out of it because most of it was either charities or churches with not that much money. So from a business point of view, it wasn't great. The other thing that we realized was that A couple of things. One was Google G Suite back then. I think it was called something. It was starting to come out. Google Calendar was something at the infancy. So there was a lot of things that we did around Calendar that basically were just useless at that point. And the other thing was that onboarding was a pain. We had to go through the payroll, get everybody onboarded. There were no like directories. We didn't do like LDAP or whatever else to bring people on board. And it was only two of us. So onboarding was really a big pain. After a while, the business just didn't get that far. The money that was coming in was not enough to be worth it, to be honest.
Was that sort of demotivating, or did it was just like, okay, well, let me try something else?
Try something else. So the lesson that I learned on that one was that we're going to have to be more forward-looking in terms of what's in the market, what other tools can be used to do the same thing that we do right now. In this case, a normal calendar replaced a lot of functionality that we would provide. And remember back then, there was no calendar. Online calendar like this. Yahoo had something, but it wasn't that great. That was one. And the second one was if you don't want to build Salesforce, then you have to have a very easy onboarding experience. It's kind of like you cannot have both. The cost of sales cannot be at a level that you need to have an account manager and onboarding and a pre-sales engineering and all that sort of stuff. Then you sell it for $20 a month. Not going to work. So you need at least about $5,000 a year for an account manager to just pay for itself. So that's the kind of idea that the thing that I learned from that.
So what came next? What after that you guys realized, hey, this isn't going to work. Like, what'd you move on to after that?
Yes. So then my co-founder at Onyaka moved on to go back and earn some money because he used up all of his package that he took away, and I started this social search engine called Sentiment. The idea was that it was your personal kind of private Google. You would connect it to your Facebook, Twitter, back then RSS feeds and all that kind of other things, and it would just read them, index them, so you could search for what you've already read. It was, I think the slogan was, "You read, I remember." And that was kind of the idea, and we did that. And we were picked up by TechCrunch, and we got the hug of death. I remember having that kind of moment that every major city would come online, like Tokyo, and then we would go down. And then, another city would come, Sydney would come up online, and we'd go down. So it was a fun 24 hours. And we did that, and we ended up with like 8,000 signs up a day. It was great. We had, founders of Foursquare and a lot of other, when I looked at the back of the emails that signed up for that service, it was amazing. Then we added geospatial search, places that you've been on Yelp and everything else. So we did a lot of those things around it. But at the end of the day, and we ran it for a good while, it was a very successful, very popular product that we had. And there was another company that got out exactly doing the same thing around the same time. And we always thought that, we scared them out of closet almost. They wanted to kind of run probably a bit longer in stealth. But because TechCrunch ran this article, they kind of had to announce that they come out. Learning from our first lesson to beat the market, they came out. It was called Gremlin back then, and I think they ended up being a YC company, or they were already a YC company. It was called Gremlin. They came out doing exactly the same thing, and TechCrunch also ran a bunch of stories around them. They had really high caliber investors, so they gave them a lot of boost. And what I realized was from that company ended up being extremely loss-making. The amount of money that we had to pour into it just to figure out how to monetize it was just astonishing. We burned a lot of money on that business, and we didn't have any monetization plan. How would you monetize this? I mean, we could go down the route of making it a financial product, monitoring tweets or public announcements by stock traders so they don't advise you know, any stock indications if they're not allowed to, and kind of go down the route of using our search technology for compliance, or get advertisements within your feed. We didn't really want to do that. It was like kind of Google's thing. So it was pretty scary to burn a lot of money and have no idea how this ever is going to turn into an actual business. So we lost quite a good amount of money around that. And Gremlin ended up changing their name to Q. And they sold the assets of the company to Apple, which turned out to be Spotlights and what you see now on iPhones as the technology behind that. So that ended up being a successful thing. But again, they couldn't figure out a kind of a monetization as per business. It was mostly, you know, they sold the company to find a better home, who would subsidize the cost of it. So that was financially not a viable decision. And the lesson that I learned from that was that I want to build my business in a way that if I sell one, I make a dollar. If I sell two, I make two. I don't want to get to like a traction something until I figure out how I can make, there's no like momentum. I want to have a business that has good unit economics.
So were you guys completely self-funding sentiment? When you realize that this isn't going to work, like, were you in a position where you had to, it was like this, we have to figure out how to make this work, or we need to go ahead and shut it down? Or like, did you have, you know, enough money to just like kind of keep trying for a while?
No,
like,
we didn't have any money. We just ran out of money. Basically, personally, we spent a fortune on making it work. And as you can imagine, this is a very expensive operation to run. The costs were mostly around storage and compute, as well as a lot of privacy things. We had, technically, we were indexing people's private emails and Twitter public, but direct messages on Twitter or Facebook feeds. So we had to spend a lot of money on security, encryption, making sure everything is completely audited. People were trusting us with very important information, and that was costly and stressful at the same time. And there's another thing about the appeal, obviously. I mean, the appeal of what you want to make. I say this now, and there's like 20 different things that come to your probably head that's like, you know, you can make money from it like this, or you can make money from it like that. Sure. But a lot of it's about the appeal of what you want to do. I mean, clearly, we could read people's emails and, you know, I'd make advertisement suggestions based on that. But this is not something that we wanted to do. Or having advertisement there is not something we wanted to do. So there was a lot of, I don't want to call it a principle, but it just was not the business that I would get excited about, you know, influencing people based on what they say on a private email.
Right. Okay, so you guys are sort of forced to shut it down just because you ran out of money.
Yeah.
And then what did you do after that?
So after that, I needed to recover, that's for sure. I went and got a job in a bank. Again, I mostly worked for investment banks in my life when I've ever had a proper job, sure. Which pays well. So I made a bunch of money from just working around those things, contracting mostly. And then back in 2011, I left banking. There was an episode that just made me think about where my values are. At Lehman Brothers, now the story is pretty much public. The story is very well documented in a enjoyable kind of format in The Big Short. But that's a movie for everyone. It's kind of memories for me. One of the things that happened that once when Lehman's went down, I was moved to a subsidiary of Lehman Brothers. I wasn't technically left kind of holding a box. The company offered me to move to a subsidiary of Lehman Brothers. And just a kind of a brief thing around this whole thing, obviously happened during great securitization of residential backed mortgages, where basically we would buy mortgages from other banks who would lend to people who cannot afford it, and they will pass it on to some other investors that would invest into these companies that would create and pay back the bond. Well, that was the theory, but it never worked out from a mathematical point of view. And some of those mortgages were not resellable. Those used to be called sludge. I think that was the term that internally was used for those mortgages. Mortgages that were delinquent, we couldn't resell them legally. So there are these companies that subsidiaries of Lehman Brothers. I'm not even sure if I'm going to get into trouble for saying this. There were these companies that Lehman Brothers set up or bought that were basically servicing those delinquent mortgages, mortgages that Lehman's could not sell, but they also didn't want to keep it on their books. And I was moved to one of those things. So one day I go in and I looked at the database. I remember we had this Oracle database, and I was looking at the database fields to learn and like understand the schema. And I learned that there are three different types of dealing with status of a house and when it comes to eviction. And it was quiet, noisy, and empty. And I asked, what are the difference between those things? And somebody told me that empty is, you know, when people back then used to call it like jingle mail. You basically, they'll put the keys in an envelope and send it to the bank because the value of the house is so below the mortgage that they've taken that it's just not worth living there. It's just, you know, holding on to that asset. They will just send the keys back to the bank and move out. That's empty. And quiet was when the bank would repossess the house. They will go to the court, get an officer, go to somebody's house and kick them out of their house, and they would just quietly leave. And normal was then when they would kick a fuss. So normal was when you would go and kick somebody out of their houses and they will put up a fight. And that was a day that I did not want to work in this industry ever again. I did not feel comfortable being in that position. And I knew that you have to sign that your house is at risk if you take on this mortgage. And I knew all of the legal things that we had to protect ourselves for this to be legally a legal thing. But morally and ethically, I could not be in that business. I couldn't get paid by knowing that what I do indirectly contributes to somebody being kicked out of their houses because they couldn't pay off their mortgages. Yes, I do know that. But still, you know, I could have done something else that did not involve any of this. Sure. And so I left. I left banks and being in that position. And then I went to, I moved to San Francisco. I moved to San Francisco, started in a company as employee number three, started the engineering part of it, and stayed in San Francisco startup scene for a year before moving back to London and just starting Cloud 66.
So the move to San Francisco, like, and I guess you said you were there for about a year.
Yeah.
Like, what did that like give you some sort of, I don't know, motivation or the idea for Cloud 66, or like what sort of did you take away from your year living in San Francisco?
Well, there was part of it. The idea came from mostly around the Lehman days, oddly enough. So the contrast between my work at a bank, in a large investment bank, and my work at a startup as number three kind of gave me the idea for Cloud 66. I remember at Lehman's, we had this mortgage trading system that I wanted to roll out into production. So I went to my boss and said, So the code's ready. We've done the tests. You know, we've done this and this and this. Now we need to roll it out onto the trading floor. How does that work? I've never done this. And he said, oh, that's easy. Just ask for a couple of servers on the second floor. It's a data center. And then you would fill out these forms, and then the ops guys will give you the access to the servers, and that's it. So I filled out the ticket. It was a system called Remedy. I filled out the ticket and I sent it over. And then like 2 weeks later, I got an email saying that we don't have any free servers on the rack. We ordered a bunch from like HP or whoever. We'll let you know. So my name is on this ticket and I get updates. And then like a month later, I get an update. It's like the servers are here. So I run downstairs to the second floor. It's like, great. Can I have access? What's the IP address? What's the root access? And I go, whoa, hang on a second. Yeah, we have the servers, but we have to now blast them. We're going to put the software on it. We have to do this and this and this and this and this. And we'll let you know. So lo and behold, about 8 weeks, maybe more later, I had two blinking Linux cursors in front of me for two servers. Now, fast forward, I'm working in a startup and we were hosting, I think, with Rackspace. I go to a dashboard, I click a button, and 5 minutes later, I had a blinking Linux cursor in front of me. And that contrast to me was like, wow. So we've reduced the time that it takes to have a server in front of you from 8 weeks to 5 minutes. But what I did to that server to get my application running after that blinking Linux cursor was in front of me was exactly the same. I had to do exactly the same thing, write a Chef script and a Puppet script and, you know, run it and whatever else that was back then. So I thought, what if that part was also productized? So I could get the server, then connect it to my code and say, thank you very much. Can you make this server do what I want it to do? And then 5 minutes later, I have the server provisioned the right way. And that's why we started Cloud 66.
With Cloud 66, did you go into it feeling like this had some sort of business legs, I guess, or did it still sort of feel like a sort of a shot in the dark?
No, we thought about this. I mean, I think having gone through what we went through, we kind of probably, I think we did our homework. So we did a lot of research around one primary big question. Why is PaaS so popular with developers, but never makes a big business? And by PaaS, I mean, you know, a company like Heroku. Heroku had an exit to Salesforce, which was an anomaly. If you think about it, if you look at it from a historical trend, very few PaaSes actually have big public PaaSes have big exits. And even that, to me, what I call the PaaS cliff happens after that. Everybody starts with Heroku. Pretty much no one runs a serious business on Heroku. And this is not just Heroku's issue. It's like everybody's like this. All public PaaSes, from that to Cloud Fog or whatever that was called back then, you know, Modulus, and every PaaS that comes along, every developer loves them, and then they just disappear. So we thought, essentially what we're doing is PaaS. So what makes us different? Why would we survive? And we did a lot of kind of research around this. I remember talking to the founders of Heroku. I talked to founders of pretty much every PaaS that's not around anymore now to find out the answer to that question. And I realized the answer to the question is in unit economy. The issue with running a public PaaS is that the unit economy is decided by at the data center level, and it's decided by somebody up in Seattle. Somebody in AWS decides that they want to open up a new data center in, say, Hong Kong. And all your customers who until now are happily running out of US East 1 Heroku now all of a sudden want to run on Heroku Hong Kong, which means that you have to open up Heroku Hong Kong and you have to have a critical mass for return to justify the return of investment. And that rarely happens. That's why Heroku has, you know, as few as that they do have it. And there were other, like CloudFog, I think it was called back then, which was one of the early Cloud Foundry PaaSes that's no longer around anymore. I think they sold it to CenturyLink and they shut it down. They tried to do this by having Cloud Foundry pretty much everywhere in every data center, and that didn't work because the unit economy is at the data center. So we thought we're going to reduce the unit economy to server, and we're going to do the provisioning and everything else from outside on your own stack so you get the deals that you want from the cloud provider. Another thing that happens with Heroku is every time there's a drop, price drop on AWS, people kind of grumble a bit more. It's like, why don't we get the benefits of this price drop on Heroku? And everybody thinks that Heroku is expensive. And that's another thing around, you know, if by letting people to run on their own servers, we let them benefit from the price drop of the cloud providers. And the third thing about the expensiveness of it was that we realized we analyzed a lot of Heroku or PaaS. I mean, I'm not singling out Heroku, PaaS bills, and we realized that out of about 10K that you pay to Heroku, 6K goes to Heroku, 3 to 4K goes to all these add-on providers. And these add-on providers are going to be successful if they're open source and they are industry standards with like MySQL or SSL or something that you can just replace with somebody else. So they tend to be a plug on the wall that you can just unplug and put it into another one and you get the same service. So none of those add-on providers will make that much money by providing a standard open product, but it's a very damn difficult thing to run. At that scale. So it's a very expensive operation to run, but doesn't return that much. So for all those reasons, we decided to change the business model at Cloud 66 or adopt a business model at Cloud 66 that does not rely on add-ons making money from an external entity. It does not own the stack all the way down to the cloud provider. It provisions it from outside as opposed to having to install Cloud 66 on every new data center that Amazon or Google decide to open up. And by that, we turned that into a profit-making, cash flow positive early on company that's profitable and still around, and we don't have any intention to go away.
So, how did you guys figure out the unit economics of that, whereas like all the previous people did not? I mean, like, is it just you had the benefit of them having already sort of, you know, hit all the weak spots and learn from their mistakes, or?
Yes, I think two things happened. One is definitely, I cannot deny the fact that you know, a lot of things that we learned was based on the mistakes that other people, the mistakes that other people made, and we made a lot of mistakes that hopefully is going to be a lesson for the next person. But you know, that's you know, I cannot take any credit for that. It's just their generosity with their time and telling me their stories and all that sort of stuff and being honest about what went wrong with all of those things. That's one. And the second one is what I've found is when it comes to developer tools, which we are one, a lot of founders focus on technology way too much. So I have seen this, that I used to go to these events and I would, you know, invite a lot of entrepreneurs and ask this question at the beginning, who runs on Heroku, who sees running themselves on Heroku for the next 5 years? And all the hands go up at the first and the second one, nobody's raising their hands. And I would ask the question, so what do you think the issue is? Everybody goes, first, it's too expensive. But then in many cases, we would get technology answers. It's like they run this like this. They use this version of whatever. The way the provision is like this, the speed of coming up something. And I couldn't accept that. I couldn't believe that the issue with PaaS is technology. And what I found is many new companies that would enter this market would focus on technology. They would replace whatever that is with Kubernetes as the backbone of their PaaS, and they think, oh, they've solved the problem now. It's because we are developers and we love doing this, and it's easy to lose sight of what actually a business is about, which is unit, and think about that we can solve this with technology. I don't think that's the case.
You kind of touched on it there, but I mean, like, how do you keep, as a, you know, a developer yourself, like, how do you keep from getting distracted by, you know, either the next shiny tool or, you know, trying to just force something to be successful based on a product? Like, how do you make sure that you stay focused on the business side to the point that it makes you guys, you know, sustainable or be able to stick around a long time?
Mm-hmm. It's difficult. I admit this as a technologist, as a person who gets excited with technologies. Sometimes I find it difficult. However, it's the good side of it is that we are now a business that we have a lot of customers who validate our model with their money and give us honest feedback because they pay us. And we have to serve them. So it's kind of being distracted is not a luxury we can afford anymore that much. There are things, and I always think that when it comes to product pipeline and what we're going to roll out next, there is the aspect of what's the latest technology, because after all, this is a early adopter market in a broader sense of the term, because developers are, by and large, you know, they're more attuned to trying new things. Especially in our customer sector, than say, you know, I don't know, cosmetics maybe, I don't know. But this is kind of the nature of our business to a degree. But at the same time, when we build the product pipeline, we look at new technologies and we look at where the company wants to go. We look at our vision. But a lot of it comes from our customers. They tell us, you know, we suck at something and we have to fix it. And they're paying us this and money for it. And we have to, we appreciate their business and we have to cater for it. So it's kind of a luxury that we don't have anymore in that way by having a real business in a way.
Got it. So something that you've mentioned a few times so far is that, you know, you like really enjoy building things, you know, all the way back from when you were a kid. Like, what is it about building or creating something that I guess that you find so intriguing?
I don't know. It just feels right. I think part of it is because, you know, I'm not good at a lot of things. I don't get a good feeling when I try them. I'm not really a sporty person. Like, you know, I suck at, you know, kicking a ball and throwing something, and that's not me. So I don't do it that much. So it doesn't give me that, you know, good feeling. And building things gives me a really good feeling. I'm not saying that I'm necessarily good at it. It's just it it's like music, you know, sometimes it resonates, and that's as far as I'd go. I've never really analyzed myself as much as saying, why do I enjoy this as much? But it certainly does. And I've realized that it's not just code or computer programs or hardware. I enjoy building businesses. I enjoy pretty much building even, you know, things with my hands, and, you know, those things. I'm not really good at those things. I know you are. It's just something that resonates with me.
And how at the sort of CEO level, like where you're, you know, running a company and you've got, you know, all the issues that come with having lots of people underneath you, like to also building this company, like how do you make sure that you still get to flex sort of those building muscles and not just get like absorbed into all that comes with running a company?
Mm-hmm. It is a balance, that's for sure, and that you have to try and strike. And I'm getting better at it in a way. I was recently reading a tweet by someone that they said, when I started the software business, I thought I'm going to do a software capital company. Now I realize I'm doing a software company capital. So it's more emphasis being on company. So I'm still doing the, you know, when you are building a company, I mean, a CEO level or at a director level, you constantly are thinking about as your job, what is my job? And a lot of people say, you know, CEO's job is to make sure the company doesn't run out of money from one day to another. And then you can interpret that as, you know, raising money or having customers or generating revenue or building a sales pipeline. But the way I see my job as a CEO is that my job is to make sure everybody else can do their job. And if I do my job right, everybody else will be able to do their job because they're great. And that will mean that we're going to have money and we're not going to run out of money. So I see that as a precursor to this company not running out of money kind of proposition. And that occupies a lot of my time, occupies me a lot of times that I think about how do people operate? How can we adopt some of the business guidance that's suitable for Fortune 500 companies or companies who have Silicon Valley venture money kind of mentality into something that's more about sustainable businesses? That's that part. But as you put it, there is a lot, and you know that better than I do, that there's a lot of admin and legal and other things that you have to attend. Updating your investors if you have any, like all of those things that we need to do. What I do is on a very practical level or pragmatic level, I run my calendar basically runs my life. I make sure that I block times off to just sit down and think. I don't touch anything. I don't write anything. I just think. And then at the end of it, I write things. And that's the time that I take off. It's a deliberate attempt to clear up your time, clear up your mind, and arrive at a clarity of thought when it comes to building a structure that's about serving people and customers and generating revenue.
Yeah, I do the same thing with blocking time on a calendar, and like that's almost the only way that I found. Like in my head, I wish I was this sort of like free flowing, you know, like my calendar stays wide open and I'll just like fill it with the things that matter. But I have to, you know, say here's 2 hours towards this, 3 hours towards that. Otherwise, you know, nothing gets done basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
So for you guys, I'm sort of like wrapping things up here. So what's the next year look like for you and for Cloud 66?
So, one of the things that we tried to do for the past, 5 years, since 2014, 2015, 4 or 5 years, is that we saw infrastructure and containers or containerization of infrastructure being an emerging force in reducing the cost of running a SaaS business. Whether it's about the cost that you or the money that you pay to the cloud provider, or whether it's about reducing the cost of downtime or reducing the probability of having a hit when it comes to running your SaaS business. So this is, you know, this technology, containerization, Docker in specific, or Kubernetes, can potentially help a lot of customers, a lot of people, SaaS businesses specifically, small SaaS businesses, to be more efficient and work better. So one of the things that we did since then is to invest heavily in that technology, but we did it in a way that is, again, sustainable. So when we started working on containers, a lot of other companies did that as well at the same time. And one of the things that happened is a lot of those companies, great friends of ours, they went out and raised a bunch of money from venture capital. And they either subsidized it on some sort of open source project that they wanted to open source because of the wrong reasons, I'd say, just to get mind share or as a marketing tool, while the business behind it was not really defined in that sense, like how you're going to make money from that open source tool. So a lot of money was spent on sustaining a very expensive IP operation around operating something that doesn't lead to any business. And other companies in the space went around building businesses that ended up being having wrong unit economy around, so things that look like PaaS, but they're just powered by Kubernetes with Docker. So fundamentally, they're not that different. And four years on, what we see is a lot of those companies either have folded or they were acquired for their talent or IP, which usually is a great outcome for the founders, but not necessarily everybody involved, especially investors, if there were any, or they turn into consultancies, which isn't there's nothing wrong with it as in terms of like running a consultancy business. It's just not that what they started and they had to change because, you know, they had bills to pay. What we did was to try to take it easy and take it in a sustainable way. So now where we are is that we have a great technology stack, loyal and a great customer base that are on the right segment of the market where we are addressing. And we're very excited about the product pipeline that we have that could benefit our customers, existing customers or future customers within this market, which is small businesses, startups, digital agencies, contractors, to benefit from the cost reduction and the high availability that containers and Kubernetes will bring. So 2019, going forward for us, is a lot about focusing on startups, focusing on small businesses, and delivering what they can benefit from containers and this new technology, where they wouldn't have otherwise been able to if they didn't have, you know, an army of 100 SREs like Google, hundreds of SREs like Google, or a lot of money to spend on cloud. So for us, a lot of 2019 is about that.
So I think that's interesting to me that it's like when you go after, say, startups or, you know, really small companies, it's like you're taking a bet or a gamble on them, you know, becoming a larger customer down the road. Like how do you keep that from being too much of a financial drain?
That's a good question. So that's how I started. That's how we thought about it at the beginning. We had, naturally, as a new technology, new company, early adopters, we have a lot of startups that use Cloud 66. And at the beginning, we were nervous about this. As you and I know, 60% of companies, startups, just don't make it past the first year or second. So how would you do that? But one realization that happened to us after having been in this business and selling to the same companies for now 7 years is that companies do die, but engineers don't. We have a lot of our customers who come to us and sign up and use the product and use the system because there was an engineer in a previous startup that didn't work out. And now they've gone into a bigger company, a way bigger company. I don't think I can reveal the names, but there's a lot of large companies that we have as our customers, and we've been blessed and fortunate enough to have them because there was an engineer who was a founder of some company that unfortunately didn't make it, but the engineers don't die. So the thing that I usually kind of think about is like startups are explosive, and when they explode, engineers go and lodge themselves into different companies as like shrapnels. They just go there and then they take us. Hopefully we've done a good enough of a job, so they trust us again and they come back. And that's how we get a lot of new business. That's just, so we actually, it's very good for us in that sense, working with startups.
Yeah, I think it's, to me, it seems like a really wise move if you plan on, you know, sticking around for a while, right? Like, so like the fact that you guys have been around for what, 7 years or something, like,
yeah,
so many companies never make it that far at all. And so going after, you know, say startups or something like that would not, it can be a really risky move. But I mean, you know, you've already proved if you've hung around for 7 years already, it's like the odds are already pretty good for you to be around for another 7 years, you know.
Hopefully. There is all that, and then, you know, we sell tools to engineers. So that's one thing that's interesting in the space of the fights that are going on between cloud providers as well. Another thing that we see happen is a lot of these cloud providers go and give away free vouchers and $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 worth of free cloud or whatnot to startups. And a lot of startups don't have the time to leverage that and to use those things. So, you know, technically they get the voucher, put it in a drawer, and then carry on Heroku until they cannot. And one of the things that we do is that we go in with those cloud providers. We let them use that credit as a customer of Cloud 66. So we enable that, which means that cloud providers really love what we do. At the same time, startups really benefit from that because they get $100,000 worth of, you know, free, good quality cloud vouchers where they can actually use, and they don't have to spend the, you know, lifetime just figuring out now what happens under the hood with Amazon. So we do that quite a lot. And that's another advantage of working with startups.
Yeah, that's great. Well, how can people follow along with you and with Cloud 66?
So obviously we have cloud66.com that you can go and check out the products. It's a lot about making DevOps, acting as your outsourced DevOps team, if you will. We have products that act as your DevOps as a service. We are a small team, but hopefully our products can help you a lot with your DevOps practices. Personally, for myself, you can find me at Cash on Twitter. I'm not as prolific on Twitter as you are, but I always keep an eye and try to be helpful there. And Cash at Cloud 66 is my email. If you have any questions that I would be able to answer, help, anything that you think that I might be helpful or useful, please send an email, Cash at Cloud 66, and I'll be more than happy to answer.
Awesome. Well, this is great, Cash. Thanks so much for hopping on the call.
No worries. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. There we have it. Cash Sajati, founder of Cloud 66. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I would love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on Twitter @Spigvard. Head to founderchats.com to listen to lots of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing this with your friends goes a long way. Thanks again, and see you next week.